You can see the title of the lesson today is Standing in the Gap, and I want to give you the background to that statement. It comes from Ezekiel, the 22nd chapter, verse 30. And as we look over there to that passage, we see that it says, particularly, "And I searched for man among them who should build up the wall and stand in the gap before me, for the land that I should not destroy it, but I found no one. Thus I have poured out my indignation on them. I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath. Their way I have brought upon their heads, declares the Lord God." So the expression "standing in the gap" is taken from Ezekiel 22, verse 30. Let me give you a little background to that statement and explain it a bit before we proceed. The Bible uses a lot of metaphors, figures of speech, which make it more picturesque and thus gets our attention and impresses upon us the important principles that it has to teach. And as we'll see, this is one of them, standing in the gap. But what is the background to that expression? It alludes to the fact that ancient city dwellers, such as in ancient Palestine, fortified their cities by encircling them with large, high stone walls for their security and protection. Otherwise, enemies and even thieves could easily come in, kill and destroy, and take their property. But it was difficult for enemies or thieves to assault cities which had these high stone walls around them, because they would either have to get through the walls or under the walls or over these walls without being detected. And that was very, very difficult. Essentially, they could not do that. If they tried to attack openly, they would be fended off. Watchmen or sentries were always stationed on the ramparts of these walls to look for any threats to the city and its residents. And if they saw any threats approaching, then they would sound the alarm and more troops and defenders would then come to the walls of the city to defend it. Now, during the day, when the enemies could be observed from a great distance away and therefore were not such a threat, the gates of the city were left open and people could easily go in and go out. But during the night, well, the gates had to be shut because the enemy could not be observed from a distance. And the residents of the city who had gone out to their fields outside the city to work in their fields and so forth, they would have to come in before dark when the gates were going to be shut and take up residence in their homes there. And then at dark, the gates would be shut because otherwise the enemy might approach under the cover of darkness. It's interesting to note there's an allusion to this fact in the story of Rahab and the two Israelite spies. You may be familiar with that story, but it's interesting to note that in Joshua, the second chapter, verse 5, Rahab is explaining to the king or his agents about the Israelites. And it came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. I do not know where they went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. So they went after them. It says in verse 7, so the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan to the fords. And as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. So it was dark, but they opened the gate just long enough to let out the pursuers. So that was the practice. What were the options for an enemy army that was approaching a walled city then? Well, there weren't many, and none of them were easy. If they wanted to get into a walled city, they might try to search for or ask about any secret entrance into the city. And there is an occasion when this actually happened in Judges 1, 24 through 26. But ordinarily, and I imagine almost all the time, they simply had to attack the walled city. So they had to go through the long, arduous, dangerous, difficult process of laying siege to the city. And during that siege, they would, in some cases, try to tunnel under the walls and literally undermine the walls so that they would collapse. Otherwise, they would try to go over the walls. Sometimes they would use scaling ladders to do that. Sometimes they would construct large high towers so that any archers and so forth attacking could overlook the defenders on the ramparts of the wall and shoot at them. Sometimes they would build mounds of earth and stones and I guess maybe even trees, whatever it took, to build mounds around the city in order to get high enough to attack the or shoot at the defenders. Ultimately, though, they would try to go through the walls. How would they do that? Well, basically, you have to knock a hole in the wall with a battering ram. So that's the idea of standing in the gap. The gap was a breach, or basically a hole in the wall that was created by perhaps a battering ram. I don't know otherwise how the walls would have been knocked down. But basically what it boiled down to, it was a matter of encircling the city so that the defenders could not get out, they could not get food or any of the other necessities of life. And sometimes these sieges then might last as long as 3 years. I believe the siege of Samaria in 2 Kings, the 17th chapter, lasted 3 years. Can you imagine that? So the king who was attacking had to maintain his army and provide them with all the food that they needed and so forth and the weaponry in order to lay siege to this city for 3 years. And basically it was a matter of kind of waiting out the defenders. And the defenders over a course of perhaps years would lose their, they would run out of food and famine would occur within the city. As a result of not being able to eat, the defenders would grow weaker and weaker and simply would not be able to man the ramparts perhaps or defend themselves very well. And so it's just a matter of attrition then, just breaking down the strength and the will of the defenders so that they could eventually knock down the walls, create a gap in the wall, so then the attackers could pour through upon the defenders and the residents of the city. That's the background. But the gap to which Ezekiel refers in chapter 22, verse 30, is a moral, a symbolic, an ideological, a spiritual gap, not a literal one, of course. God's law is like a wall which surrounds and protects a person. And unless he allows a gap to occur through his own sin, well, he'll be protected. But as we know, people don't always obey the law of God. They allow those breaches or gaps to be knocked into the wall by satanic forces, and the enemy gains access to their lives. Now, of course, all of this is not hard to comprehend since the Bible itself speaks of breaking God's commandments. You know, the word breach, and that's just a longer word for gap, the word breach and the word break come from the same root. Sin, then, is a breaching of God's protective wall, which stands between a person and Satan, and hence between a person and God's wrath, which would break forth upon the sinner. 1 John 3, verse 4 in the King James Version says, sin is a transgression of the law. And it's interesting to note that in 1 Chronicles we have a scene that quite well represents these facts I've just submitted to you. That what you have is, first, the sinner creates a breach in the wall of God's law by his transgression of God's law. And as a result, God's wrath as an enemy gets to pour in through that breach. Now, the idea in this lesson is that if a breach occurs, you need to get up and you need to stand in that breach and meet the attackers who would otherwise come pouring in and fend them off. And God was looking for someone in Ezekiel 22 who would stand in the gap. But he found no one. And that was very sad. But as I was saying, in 1 Chronicles, there is a picture of this very thing. In 1 Chronicles, the 13th chapter, David is wanting to bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. only it is transported contrary to the ordinance of God on an ox cart rather than on the shoulders of the priest or Levites. And what happens? Well, as we see farther down in chapter 13, in verse 9 beginning, it says, when they came to the threshing floor of Kidon, Uzzah put out his hand to hold the ark, because the oxen nearly upset it, and the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, so he struck him down there, because he put out his hand to the ark, and he died there before God. Then David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah, and he called that place Perez Uzzah to this day. Perez in Hebrew means breach or gap. Now, David is looking at it from his perspective. He thinks God's wrath has breached a protective wall against Uzzah and come in upon Uzzah. But as we see later on, he adopts a different, more correct perspective on the matter. Going to chapter 15 now of 1 Chronicles, we see that he calls together the priests and the Levites, and he says to them, among other things, because you did not carry it at the first, the Lord our God made an outburst on us, for we did not seek him according to the ordinance. So he sees it more clearly now. We were the one that created the breach that allowed God's wrath in upon Uzzah, because we breached God's law. We broke his law because the ark was transported on an ox cart instead of, according to the law, by poles on the shoulders of the priests or Levites. Now, what we see here is that each Christian will inevitably find it necessary at times to stand in the breach or the gap. Or if there is already one, to repair it. He's got to repair any breaches in his own protective wall. And then once he's done that, he's got to repair as much as he can the breaches others have created in their own defensive walls. The gospel is about standing in the breach to repel the satanic invaders who would otherwise enter. It's about repairing the breaches made by sin. As a matter of fact, in Isaiah the 58th chapter, verse 12, this analogy is used again. Isaiah 58 verse 12 says, and those from among you will rebuild the ancient ruins. You will raise up the age-old foundations, and you will be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of the streets in which to dwell. That's what we should be as Christians. The coming of Christ to die on the cross for our sins involved a repair of the walls made in the house of David. Of course, the house of David was the dynasty of David. And Jesus fulfilled the promise of God in 2 Samuel 7 to become the king on David's throne. And in this way, the breaches in the house of David were healed. So, in Amos the 9th chapter, verse 11, we find that this is the case there. Amos the 9th chapter closes with a messianic promise. This is a messianic promise, and we know that it is because in Acts 15, verses 15 through 17, James quotes this passage and applies it to Christ and his church. So it says in Amos 9, verse 11, in that day I will raise up the fallen booth of David and wall up its breaches. I will also raise up its ruins and rebuild it as in the days of old, and so on. And yet, the efforts of Christ to repair the breaches only avails in the life of each individual as he applies that repair with the materials provided by Christ, namely his blood. And so, a little bit unusual, perhaps, but to kind of make the application first before we look at biblical examples of those who stood in the breach, let me observe that each Christian will have to make himself a spiritual Nehemiah. If you know the biblical story, Nehemiah returned to his home country and home city, Jerusalem. The Babylonians had come as a result of Judah's sins, and the Jews were taken off into Babylonian captivity. But God restored them, and among those who were restored was Nehemiah. He was very concerned about the ruined, very dilapidated condition of Jerusalem, the capital city of his people. And he wanted so much to go there and do something about it. And he was allowed by the Persian king who had succeeded the Babylonian kings to go there. And in Nehemiah 2, beginning with verse 11, we see that when he arrived, he took a night survey during which he inspected the walls of Jerusalem and saw how broken down they were, many breaches in them. And he gathered his people and said, "Here is the plan. We're going to rebuild these walls of Jerusalem. We're going to repair its breaches." That's what we have to do. We're, as Christians, repairers of the breaches in our own lives and in the lives of others. So we've got to stand in the gap. How do we do that? What does that mean? What is the practical application of standing in the gap? Well, for one thing, parents have to stand in the gap sometimes. They must create a spiritual wall between their children and sin and the forces of the world and Satan around their children. And they are many, and they're getting worse. I fear for our children today, even as they're proceeding through our public school system. You know, when I was growing up, particularly when I was going through elementary school, there was a lot of collegiality, it seemed to me, between the teachers and the parents. And they were in sync with one another. They communicated with one another. If I did anything bad at school, well, I found out that my parents would go to the PTA meeting and the teacher would communicate this to my parents. My parents would find out about it. But they communicated with one another. It was a relatively small community, the school, and people tended to share the same values. And so there was a lot of, as I said, collegiality between the parents and the teachers. And the teachers understood very well what the parents expected of them. And the parents did have expectations about them, moral expectations. Sounds a little bit odd now, but when I was going through elementary school in rural Mississippi, back in the early 60s, we opened our school day with Bible reading and prayer. That has been done away with now. I'm not trying to say necessarily that it be brought back or that children be taught religious principles in school, but it does bother me that biblical moral values are being erased from our schools and they're being replaced with a lot of liberalism. And so I say that to say that parents need to be alert. They need to take charge of their children's education and understand what they're being taught. If necessary, go through the textbooks. Talk to the teachers. Find out what is being taught to your children. We need to be providing a protective spiritual wall between our children. If there are any breaches or gaps we find occurring, we need to stand in those gaps, or parents do. Not just parents, but also, generally speaking, teachers, preachers, elders, and others. Everybody must wall members against the attacks of the world and false teachings. And as they see breaches occurring, repair them. Well, what does that mean in practical terms? Well, that's where our examples now come in. Let's look at seven Bible characters who stood in the gap in an effort to rescue others from wrongdoing. First of all, we'll start with Abraham. And since there are seven of them, and we're already well into the lesson, I won't necessarily take the time to read the entirety of these scripture citations. I will abbreviate them or might even just summarize the story to you. But in the latter portion of Genesis, the 18th chapter, we have Abraham interceding with God for Sodom. Now, he probably interceded not so much for Sodom, but for his nephew Lot, who with his family were residents of the city of Sodom. And it's really interesting to note how Abraham goes about this. He beseeches the Lord on behalf of the city of Sodom. And he starts off by saying, at the end of verse 23, "Wilt thou indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Wilt thou indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous who are in it?" And it goes on like that. I won't read the whole thing, but he gets God to drop or reduce the required number for the sparing of the city of Sodom from 50 to 45 and then to 40 and then to 30 and then the 20 and finally to just 10. And I suspect that Abraham stopped at 10 because he was hoping that with just Lot and his family in the city, 10 righteous people might be found there in the city, and Lot and his family would be spared. Later on, we find out that God did spare Lot and at least his two daughters, but in another way, by taking them out of the city, which was then destroyed. So we close out this reading with just the last two verses in the chapter. Then he said, "Oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I will speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it on account of the 10." And as soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, the Lord departed, and Abraham returned to his place. So obviously this teaches us that sometimes standing in the gap means we need to pray. We need to go to God in prayer and ask him to spare our loved ones. If they're caught up with a lot of breaches in their wall, and they don't seem to be concerned about them, and they won't let us do anything to repair them, we need to go to God in intercessory prayer on their behalf and ask the Lord, spare them, help them, pray to the Lord for them. So standing in the gap sometimes means going to God in prayer on their behalf. Now let's look at the next example, that of Reuben, who was the oldest of the 12 sons of Jacob. He provided leadership and guidance to his brothers, and in that way stood in the gap. Now this is a kind of lengthy reading, but you may be familiar with the basic story, how in Genesis 37th chapter, Joseph, the next to the youngest son, who was his father's favorite, made his brothers jealous of him. So jealous, as a matter of fact, that when he went in search of them, as they were in some relatively remote place pasturing their flocks, and he came to them, they took him and threw him into a pit. Initially, the brothers had talked about even killing him. Now, this is their brother, Joseph. Well, now, Reuben is the oldest of them, and as the oldest, he needed to provide some leadership, some counsel, some guidance. And he did. Not as he should have. We see beginning with verse 13 that the story is taken up. But later on in the chapter, they notice that Joseph is coming to them and they talk about killing him and then telling their father that a wild beast devoured him. Notice in verse 21, "But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, 'Let us not take his life.' Reuben said further to them, 'Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father.'" So Reuben is showing some leadership, but not as much as he should have. He failed in being the kind of leader he should have been. Maybe he was concerned that his brothers would reject his leadership, would reject his counsel. He was showing some timidity, but he had enough strength and enough sense as the oldest brother to tell them, "Don't kill him. We can manhandle him, throw him into this pit, but don't kill him." Now, for some reason, after they have thrown Joseph into the pit, Reuben disappears from the scene. We're not told why. During that time, the brothers get this idea to sell Joseph into, well, ultimately becomes Egyptian slavery. So in verse 29, we read, "Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So he tore his garments, and he returned to his brothers and said, 'The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?'" And many years later, maybe 20-something years later, when the brothers again meet up with Joseph in Egypt, although they don't recognize him as Joseph at that time because he's grown up so much, I suppose, and his appearance has changed, and he's second ruler in the land of Egypt at that time, he says to his brothers, Genesis 42, verse 22, even then, 2 decades later, he says, did I not tell you, don't harm the boy? But you would not listen. So he's remembering this all these years. Even though they don't recognize at this point that this is Joseph, they've encountered problems in Egypt. They've been accused of being spies in Egypt. And things are looking bad for them. And in this trouble, Reuben's mind goes back to that time when they sold their brother into Egyptian slavery. And he says to them, did I not tell you, don't harm the boy? And now look what's happened to us. You wouldn't listen. And we're in trouble. That tells me that during all this time, that guilt had been weighing down upon their minds because of what they had done to Joseph. He had kept them initially from killing him in the hope of restoring him to their father. Perhaps he was too timid to tell them his plan. Perhaps he feared their rejection of his leadership and counsel. And so they sold Joseph as a slave while he was absent. So all of this shows that sometimes to stand in the gap means to provide good counsel, leadership, and guidance as a strong leader. Reuben didn't do that to the extent that he should have, but I appreciate some effort that he made. He tried to be a leader. So sometimes standing in the gap means providing leadership and guidance. Let's look at the third example here, that of Moses. Moses represents standing in the gap by way of a willingness to make a sacrifice for others. Again, this might be a very familiar Bible story to you, but you may recall that the Israelites, as they were traveling from the land of Egypt after God had released them from bondage there to the land of Canaan, came to Mount Sinai, where God gave them the Ten Commandments and the other parts of the law of Moses. But while Moses was up on Mount Sinai, the Israelites, along with Aaron, who failed to be a leader, by the way, he should have stood in the gap, but he failed to be a leader, decided they would make this golden calf as an idol to worship. When God told Moses what the Israelites had done, he says, I'm going to destroy them for what they've done. But Moses rose up and stood in the gap between God and his people, and he interceded for them. He pleaded with God not to destroy the people. Beginning with Exodus chapter 32, verse 7, we see how Moses interceded with God. Actually, let's drop down to verse 11. Exodus 32, verse 11. Then Moses entreated the Lord, his God, and said, O Lord, why doth thine anger burn against thy people, whom thou hast brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains? And I'll stop right there. But with his arguments and with his pleadings, we see that the result is given in verse 14. So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. It even goes farther than that. In the same chapter, Exodus 32, but dropping down to verse 30, we see that it says, and it came about on the next day that Moses said to his people, you yourselves have committed a great sin, and now I am going up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. You know how he thought he might be able to make atonement if he had to? Well, let's read on. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, this people has committed a great sin, and they have made a god of gold for themselves. But now, if thou wilt forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from the book which thou hast written. Well, God didn't blot out Moses from his book. But Moses was prepared to sacrifice himself. Sometimes we see from this that standing in the gap for others requires a willingness to sacrifice ourselves, to do what we have to do, to give what we have in service to others. Fourth, there is the example of a wise woman. She's not given a name. But we read about her in 2 Samuel, the 20th chapter. In the preceding chapters, we read that David's son Absalom had risen up in rebellion against his father and was killed in the process. But we come to this story about another rebel, Sheba by name. Perhaps Sheba thought, well, now David has been weakened by his battle with Absalom. Perhaps now I can do something. And it says in verse 1 of 2 Samuel 20, now a worthless fellow happened to be there whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew the trumpet and said, we have no portion in David. So, again, to summarize, he rebelled against David. And it did not go well for him. He had to flee. And Joab, David's general, pursued him all the way, as a matter of fact, to a city named Abel Beth Maacah. Sheba had taken refuge in that city. Well, what did Joab do? He did what generals typically do in a situation like that. He laid siege to the city. And so we read later on, dropping down to verse 15, that it says, and they came and besieged him in Abel Beth Maacah. And they cast up a mound against the city, and it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall, get that breach in the wall. Then a wise woman called from the city, hear, hear, please tell me, Joab, come here that I may speak with you. So he approached her, and the woman said, are you Joab? And he answered, I am. Then she said to him, listen to the words of your maidservant. And he answered, I am listening. Then she spoke, saying, formerly they used to say, they will surely ask advice at Abel. And thus they ended the dispute. I am of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You are seeking to destroy a city, even a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? And Joab answered and said, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. Such is not the case. But a man from the hill country of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has lifted up his hand against King David. Only hand him over, and I will depart from the city. And the woman said to Joab, behold, his head will be thrown to you over the wall. Then the woman wisely came to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they were dispersed from the city, each to his tent. Joab also returned to the king at Jerusalem. That's all it took. I know it's gruesome, but that's the way things went back then. But think about what this wise woman did. You'd think, okay, rather than going through all this rigmarole of besieging the city, and this is an Israelite city now, so you got Israelites against the Israelites. But you've got this woman in this city who has some sense in her head, and she goes out to Joab and says, what's this all about? And so they exchange ideas. Basically, she says, I'm kind of reading between the lines here, okay, is that all you want? Well, later on, the head of Sheba comes over the wall. That's all it took. And instead of maybe thousands of people getting killed, just this one man, the rebel, was killed. So what do we have here? We see that standing in the gap requires sometimes timely and wise intervention. Get the facts. Go ask for some information. Find out if there's a way that we can come to an accommodation or compromise with one another. And propose a simple solution. Sometimes it's a simple solution. But all of that comes about simply by someone having the good sense to intervene, to step in and say, what can we do about this? So sometimes standing in the gap involves intervention. Let's move on to the next example. An unnamed mother. She is an example of the fact that sometimes love has to stand in the gap. Again, I don't think I'm going to take the time to read this story because it's a familiar one, I think. Even to those who are not Bible readers or students, I think are familiar with this story from Solomon. So in 1 Kings 3, 16 through 28, we read that two harlots were living together, and they gave birth to children about the same time. Well, the child of one died in the night. When she woke up and found out that her child was dead, she took her dead child and put it in the place of the other woman's living child and took the living child to herself. When the mother of the living child woke up and found out that the child was dead, she recognized, "This is not my child." Well, the case was brought before wise King Solomon, and he had just come to the throne. And this was the case that really helped all Israel to recognize how suitably wise their king was, even though he was young. And each of these women was claiming, "Well, this is my child. The other one's lying." Well, how would you know? Solomon arranged what we might call a test of love. He said, "Bring a sword and cut the child in half and give each mother or each claimant half the child." And the mother of the dead child basically said, "That's a good idea. It won't be her child or mine. Go ahead and divide the child in half." But what did the mother of the living child say? "No, no, please don't. Let her have the child. I would rather her have the child and the child be allowed to live." Now, what would you do in a situation like that? If it was a choice between your child being dead or your child being allowed to live but taken from you, what would you do? Well, I would think, we can put it in harsh terms, allowing the child to live but to be taken from us would be the lesser of two evils. But anyway, when the actual mother of the child said this, "Don't kill the child, let her have the child as a living child," Solomon recognized who the actual mother was. He had applied the test of love and said, "She is the mother." Because he knew no mother, contrary to what it's like today, it seems, no mother would say, "I would rather have my child dead." So, when someone loves another enough, we learn from this, to risk losing him for the greater good, it is then that his or her love reaches its pinnacle. I've noticed that sometimes today, people are fearful of teaching Christ's word to their friends or maybe their family members, their loved ones, because they fear that doing so would threaten the relationship, and they would rather keep the relationship intact than spare their friends or the family members' souls. Matthew 10, verse 37, says this, "He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." We've got to have that greater love for Christ, such a love for Christ that it's willing to risk losing a relationship. Let's next proceed to the example of Obadiah. We're on our sixth example here, so this one and then the next one, and we'll bring the lesson to a close. In 1 Kings, the 18th chapter, we find that Obadiah was a steward over the household of two of the most wicked sovereigns Israel ever had, Ahab and Jezebel. You may recognize the names. Despite that, though, he was a righteous man, and when Jezebel, the wicked queen, was killing the Lord's prophets, he made arrangements to save them. He stood in the gap for them. Later on, when he was on a mission for his master, he met the prophet Elijah, and Elijah told him, "Go and fetch King Ahab for me." And Obadiah said, "I don't want to do that because I may go to get the king and bring him to this spot. And when we get back here, you may be gone and it's going to cost me my life." But Elijah urged him to go ahead and get Ahab anyway, and assuring him, "I'll be here when you return with Ahab." And he was there. But what's happening here? Obadiah is willing to risk himself and his life in order to do what is right. He exposed himself to danger by saving God's prophets and then later telling Ahab to go to meet Elijah, though he feared Elijah might leave the place. So we learn from this that standing in the gap sometimes involves exposing ourselves to danger or condemnation. In Matthew, the 10th chapter, verse 28, there it says, "And do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." In the latter portion of the verse, he refers to God, who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. So that's the greater danger. And he's saying, therefore, be willing to expose yourself to the danger of having your body killed, because that's the lesser danger. Don't be afraid of that, or at least don't be as afraid of that as you are of God and his ability to destroy both soul and body in hell. So sometimes standing in the gap means we've got to be willing to expose ourselves to danger and condemnation, to take risks. We're taking something of a risk here today in light of the pandemic to even meet. And I'll have to tell you, especially after having come back from a trip down south and meeting with other churches and hearing other stories, COVID has done a great deal, not just of physical damage, but of spiritual damage on people. I have been told of churches that have divided over the approach to it. I've heard of a church, it was a small church, but didn't meet for 2 years at all, inside or outside, because of COVID. COVID has exposed a lot of spiritual weakness. Now, I realize that we need to be reasonable in the way we approach health dangers. But there's got to be a balance there. And I know sometimes it's difficult to find that balance between doing what is reasonable with respect to our health and yet serving God at the same time. And it's hard sometimes to find that balance, and we have struggled here with this. I think we've done pretty well. That's my opinion anyway. It may not be yours, but pretty well trying to find a balance there. But we're over 2 years into this pandemic now, and we've learned more. And we've gotten vaccinations available to us and so forth, and people have different opinions about those things. But my point is this. And I've said this before, service to God and to our brethren is something we cannot make risk-free. We have to take some reasonable risks. Even driving to the church building and then driving home afterwards exposes ourselves to risk. We could get into traffic accidents and even be killed in a worst-case scenario. We don't live in a risk-free, danger-free world, and our service to God is certainly not danger-free. And we as Christians then, like Obadiah, need to be willing to stand in the gap sometimes by being willing to take a certain level of reasonable risk. Last example. Well, of course, Christ stood in the gap. He stood in the gap by his death. There are a lot of passages to that effect. I just selected John 10, verse 11, where he says he is the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep, and that's what he did. But with the spiritual wall of everyone full of sin's breaches, Christ died to stand in the gap and repair the gaps in our spiritual defensive walls. I'll close with this point by making reference, and I told you I would come back to the name Perez. Perez means breach or gap in Hebrew. In Genesis, the 38th chapter, we find that Judah, and Judah was an ancestor of Christ, but Judah committed some bad sins in this chapter. He created a Perez, a breach in the wall. For one thing, I don't know how to put this, unbeknownst to himself, he committed fornication with his daughter-in-law, thinking she was a harlot. say, unbeknownst to him, how that happens. Well, just read Genesis 38. You'll find out there. But anyway, that's not really pertinent to the point. As a result of this liaison, she became pregnant. He was going to have her executed for her harlotry until she was able to provide proof that he was the father of her children. They were twins. And let's just read the last two or three verses of the chapter, beginning with verse 27 of Genesis 38. And it came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. Now, that was important in those days because the firstborn got more privileges back then. So she wanted to make sure of the twins, you know, later on it's going to be hard to tell them apart. So let me identify the firstborn by tying a scarlet thread around his hand. But then something odd happens. Verse 29. But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez. And afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. This is all really interesting because it's possible that Perez, meaning breach, might have a double meaning or application. First of all, his father had committed terrible sins, but also he supplanted his brother, overtook his brother in the birth process. So what do you have here? The second twin was named Zerah, brightness or dawning. He emerged with the scarlet thread, which had been intended to identify him as the firstborn, even though he was the secondborn. Now, you can see some typology in that, because Perez was the one who became the direct ancestor of Jesus. Jesus fulfilled any typology the twins Perez and Zerah had by following the breach maker, Perez, representing Judah's sin, and identifying himself with the scarlet-bearing Zerah. Later on, he wore at his crucifixion, about that time, a scarlet robe, Matthew tells us in Matthew 27:28. And by standing in the gap, so to speak, made himself the firstborn in a spiritual sense. A lot of interesting typology there, but Christ stood in the gap for us. In conclusion, then, Christ ultimately became the one to stand in the gap and to make intercession, as we read, he ever does so in Hebrews 7, verse 25. But it is also necessary for us, as servants of Christ, to go on the offensive and make gaps, breaches, in the wall of sin and false teaching. Because that's what Christ did as he breached himself. The wall of sin that separated human beings from one another and also human beings from God. I'll close with a reading from Ephesians 2, verses 11 through 16 to that effect. He's talking about the Jews and the Gentiles. But even beyond that, talking about reconciliation between human beings and God. Therefore, remember that formerly you, the Gentiles in the flesh, who are called the uncircumcision by the so-called circumcision, which is performed in the flesh by human hands, remember that you were at that time separate from Christ, excluded from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who formerly were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who made both groups into one and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall by abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, that in himself he might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace, and might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross, by it having put to death the enmity. So, as Christians, we must stand in the gap. And not only that, sometimes go on the offensive and breach the walls of false teaching and take captive the enemy within, as we're told, and I won't read this passage, 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3 through 6. It may be that there is at least one person here today who wishes to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, recognizing that there have been breaches in his defensive wall, hurt his defensive wall. Come forward in faith and in repentance to confess before us your faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, and be baptized, immersed in a body of water, that the blood might cleanse you of your sins and usher you into Christ's kingdom. If you've done that, but since then have fallen away, and wish by confession of your sins here before us today to be renewed in your relationship with God, won't you come forward and make that known as together we stand and sing for your encouragement.